Hello, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Into the Killing. If this is your first episode, we appreciate you tuning in, and we hope you find it interesting. If you listened to other episodes, thank you so much for coming back and listening again. The case we're talking about today happened in March 1969. On March 3rd, 1969, Sirhan Sirhan admitted in court to assassinating presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy in June 1968. A week later, James Earl Ray pleaded guilty to killing civil rights leader Dr. Martin Luther King. He later recanted his plea. On March 17th, Golda Meir became Israel's first female prime minister. On March 20th, John Lennon and Yoko Ono got married. That month, 23-year-old Jane Mixer was attending the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Mixer was a freshman in law school. She was one of just 37 female law students that year. Her family lived in Muskegon, which is on the shores of Lake Michigan. It's about 170 miles northwest of the university. Mixer was a bright young woman who had been valedictorian of her high school. In her speech, which school officials did not approve, Mixer called for social justice. At university, Mixer was considered a loner, but she had been dating a young man, and they had recently gotten engaged. Mixer was looking for a ride home from university on March 20th, so she posted a message on the student university bulletin board. A man who called himself David Johnson offered to give her a ride, and Mixer accepted the offer. Mixer told her parents that they were leaving Ann Arbor around 6 p.m., and she would be at their home at around 9:30. But tragically, she never made it to her parents' home. Her father was worried, so he went out driving looking for her or any signs of a car accident. But he didn't find anything. So Mixer was reported missing. The next morning, a woman living next to a cemetery in rural Wayne County, just outside of Ypsilanti, Michigan, called the police. She had found a dead body lying on a grave. The grave was next to a drive-in entrance of the cemetery. A yellow coat was draped over her face and a blanket was covering her lower body. The woman had been shot twice in the head. A silk stocking that didn't belong to her was tied tightly around her neck. She was wearing a jumper and had been pulled up to expose her underwear. Her shoes were off and they were beside her body along with a copy of Catch-22 by Joseph Heller. A suitcase with her clothes was beside her. The body was identified as 23-year-old Jane Mixer. The medical examiner determined that she had not been sexually assaulted. The gun used to kill her was a .22 caliber handgun. Mixer had been killed elsewhere and then dumped in the cemetery. The police went to her dorm room and found an open phone book on her desk. There was a check mark next to the name David Johnson. The police interviewed the David Johnson, whose name had the check mark next to it. He claimed they never offered to give Mixer a ride home. He had an airtight alibi for the time of the murder. The night she was killed, he was acting in a play. The police investigated other David Johnsons who lived in the area, and they were all eliminated as suspects. The police concluded that David Johnson was an alias. The law school building was searched. In the basement was a phone booth. In the phone booth was a phone book, and someone had written Mixer and Muskegon on the cover. The investigators thought that the killer may have written that, so they collected the phone book as evidence. The police thought that Jane Mixer might have been killed by a serial killer who was slaughtering young female university students in Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. If a serial killer did kill Mixer, it would have been his third victim in 2 years. In July 1967, 19-year-old Mary Flazer was a student at Eastern Michigan University, also known as EMU. EMU is in Ypsilanti, which is a city that neighbors Ann Arbor. EMU is only about 6 miles from the University of Michigan. On the night of July 9th, Mary Flazer went out for a walk in Ypsilanti, but she didn't return home. A month later, on August 7th, two teenagers made a gruesome discovery on a lover's lane on an abandoned farm just north of Ypsilanti. It turned out to be the dead body of Mary Flazar. Her body was nude, and her torn clothes were found near her body. She had been stabbed at least 20 times in the chest and the abdomen. One arm had been cut off at the forearm, and the fingers on the other hand were missing. Both her feet had also been cut off at the ankles. The arm, fingers, and feet have never been found. Because of the state of the remains, the medical examiner could not determine if she had been sexually assaulted. The police knew that Flazar was killed elsewhere, and then her body was dumped in the lover's lane. The police also believe that the killer came back and moved the body to a different spot on the lover's lane. Something odd happened the day after the body was found. The remains were sent to a funeral home in Ypsilanti. A young man came into the funeral home and he told an employee that he was a friend of the Flazar family. He said that since it was a closed casket funeral, he was wondering if he could get a photograph of the body for the family. The employee of the funeral home said that wouldn't be possible. The young man said that he would be attending the funeral and then he left. As he was walking out, the employee noticed that he didn't have a camera. The employee called the police and reported the incident. The young man was never identified. No arrests were made in the case, and it went cold. A year later, on June 30, 1968, 20-year-old Eastern Michigan University student Joan Schell went missing. She was last seen getting into a red car with a black convertible top with three young men inside of it. She had been waiting on the EMU campus for a bus to Ann Arbor. She was planning on seeing her boyfriend, who was living in Ann Arbor. Her friend was keeping her company while she waited for the bus. The young man stopped and offered her a ride, so she got in. After that, she went missing. Her body was found at a construction site a week later in rural Ann Arbor. She had been stabbed 25 times in the torso and the neck. Oddly, despite the number of stab wounds and how much blood was lost, the body was relatively clean. The medical examiner thought she might have been washed after she was killed. She had been strangled with her miniskirt, which was still wrapped around her neck. She had also been sexually assaulted. The medical examiner believed that she had been dumped about 24 hours before she was found. Nearly 9 months later, Jane Mixer was killed. Tragically, if Mixer was killed by a serial killer, it wasn't his last victim. Just 2 days after Mixer's body was found, 16-year-old Marilyn Skelton was reported missing. She was last seen hitchhiking near a shopping center in Ann Arbor. She was supposed to meet a friend on the EMU campus. But she didn't show up. 2 days later, her body was found on the outskirts of Ann Arbor. She was nude and a garter belt was tied tightly around her neck. Her clothes were found close to her body. She had been beaten with a belt. Bruises in the shape of a belt buckle were visible on the body. She had also been severely beaten in the head. Her skull had 3 fractures. 3 weeks later, on April 15, 1969, 13-year-old Don Bossum was hanging out in a bad part of Ypsilanti with some friends. As the sun was setting, Don started walking home alone. She was last seen about 150 yards from her home. She lived about half a mile away from the EMU campus. Then, she went missing. Her family reported her missing that evening. The next morning, a trucker found her body in a rural area north of Ypsilanti and east of Ann Arbor. Her shirt had been pulled up and she was nude from the waist down. She had been slashed with a knife on her chest and buttocks. A black wire was tied tightly around her neck. She had also been raped. The police determined that she had most likely been raped and murdered in an abandoned barn not far from where her body was dumped. On June 7, 1969, Alice Cologne was at a party at a hall in Ann Arbor. A month later, on July 9th, her body was found near an abandoned farm north of Ann Arbor. Her body was mostly nude. Her clothes had been cut or ripped off. She had been shot 2 or 3 times in the head. She had also been slashed and stabbed in the neck and the chest. There was also evidence that she had been raped. A few weeks after Cologne's body was found, on the afternoon of July 23, 1969, 18-year-old Karen Sue Benjamin went missing. She was last seen at a wig shop in Ypsilanti, where she purchased a wig. She was given a ride to the wig shop by a young man on a motorcycle. The man was a stranger to her. The wig shop owner knew it was a stranger because Benjamin said something to the effect of that she had done 2 foolish things that day. She bought a hairpiece, and she got a ride on a stranger's motorcycle. The owner of the wig shop was well aware of the murders. She encouraged Benjamin not to get back on the motorcycle, but Benjamin ignored the advice. She got back on the motorcycle, and the young man drove off. Benjamin was an EMU student, and she lived on campus in one of the dormitories. When she didn't return home that night, she was reported missing. 3 days later, her nude body was found in a gully in a rural area just east of Ann Arbor and north of Ypsilanti. Her face had been beaten beyond recognition. Her body also had 24 puncture marks. But the cause of death was strangulation. Her underwear had been stuffed in her vagina. One thing that the police noted was that there were some short hairs in the underwear. At this point, the police were on high alert. An EMU campus patrol heard about the young man on the motorcycle, and it reminded him of someone, but he didn't know the man's name. He knew that the young man was a member of a fraternity at EMU, and he had a motorcycle. The officer went to the fraternity and described the man he was looking for. Several of the fraternity members said he was probably looking for 22-year-old John Norman Collins. Collins was a senior, and he was studying elementary education. He planned on becoming a teacher. They gave him Collins' address. When he got there, Collins was working on his motorcycle. They talked for a bit, and then a friend of Collins arrived. He had new license plates for Collins. Just before Karen Benjamin accepted a ride from the young man on the motorcycle, the same young man approached another young woman and offered her a ride. The woman made a report with the police. The campus patrol interviewed the woman and showed her a photo of Collins. She said that he was the man who offered her a ride. Collins was then placed under 24-hour surveillance. Collins' uncle was a state trooper. His uncle and his family had been away when Karen Benjamin was killed. Collins was supposed to look after their dog, which was living in the garage. He had a key to their house, but he had no reason to go in there. When his uncle and his family returned home, they noticed some strange things in their house. For example, there were scuff marks on the kitchen floor. Also, the floor in the basement had been painted in some spots with black spray paint. When Collins' uncle returned to work, he was informed that his nephew was a suspect in Karen Benjamin's murder. Collins' uncle then told his superiors about the odd things he found in his home. He agreed to let the crime lab examine his house. The crime lab found blood splatters in several parts of the basement. This included blood under the black spray paint. Before Collins' aunt, uncle, and cousin went on their trip, his aunt gave his cousin a haircut in the basement. It turned out that the hairs found on Benjamin's underwear matched the hair from his cousin's head. On July 31, 1969, John Norman Collins was arrested and charged with the murder of Karen Benjamin. After he was arrested, the police received a call from an investigator in California. He thought that John Collins might be responsible for a murder in Salinas, California. In June 1969, 17-year-old Roxy Ann Phillips, who lived in Milwaukee, Oregon, was visiting a family friend in Salinas. On June 30th, Roxy went to mail a letter, and then she was going to visit a friend. She didn't return to the home she was staying, and she was reported missing. The investigator talked to her friend that she was supposed to visit. She said that Roxy didn't show up that day. The last time she saw Roxy was the day before. They were walking, and a young man pulled up beside them. He said that his name was John, and he was from Michigan. He told them that he was studying to be an elementary school teacher. Roxy's friend said she made a date with John for the next day, but she never saw or heard from him again. Roxy's nude body was found 2 weeks after she went missing. She had been strangled to death. The police were able to confirm that John Collins was in Salinas at the time of Roxy's murder. A garage in Salinas had serviced his mother's car on July 3rd. Collins had also been treated for a rash by a doctor in Salinas. Collins' car was searched, and a piece of red fabric was found inside of it. Roxy's family friend said that the fabric was identical to the fabric of the dress she was wearing when she went missing. The laboratory also compared the fabric to the dress and found them to be identical. So Collins was also charged with Roxy's murder. The police of Michigan thought that Collins committed all 7 murders that happened between June 1967 and June 1969. But they felt like they only had a strong enough case to try him for the murder of Karen Benjamin. John Collins' trial began on July 20, 1970. The trial lasted about a month. The jury deliberated for 4 days. On August 19, 1970, he was found guilty of murder. He was sentenced to life in prison. Since he was given life without parole, he was not extradited to California to face trial for the murder of Roxy Ann Phillips. Collins maintained that he was innocent of the murders. Some people believe that he may have been innocent of at least one murder. That was the murder of Jane Mixer. Her murder had several notable differences. The first is that the other young women seemed like victims of opportunity. When they went missing, they were hitchhiking or walking. Mixer's killer arranged to pick her up. The serial killer also seemed centralized to the EMU campus. Many of the victims went missing around the campus or they were students there. Mixer was a student at the University of Michigan. Secondly, the bodies of the other victims were primarily found in the same area. It was rural areas just north of Ypsilanti and east of Ann Arbor. Alice Cologne was the exception because her body was found northwest of Ann Arbor. But she was still found north of Ypsilanti. Mixer's body was found east of Ypsilanti. No other bodies were found east of Ypsilanti. All the other bodies were dumped in rural areas. But Mixer's body was found in a cemetery next to a house. All the other victims were found nude or mostly nude. Even though evidence can be found during each autopsy, it's believed that the women were all raped. Mixer's underwear was exposed, but she still had her clothes on and she had not been raped. Many of the victims had been stabbed, a lot of them were tortured, and many of them were mutilated. Mixer's body didn't have any signs of that type of trauma. So in 2001, 33 years after Jane Mixer's murder, her case was reopened. The evidence was examined for DNA. In the fall of 2004, a match to the DNA was found. It was the DNA of 62-year-old Gary Letterman. Letterman was a retired nurse. Letterman's DNA was in the system because in 2001, he was arrested for passing a forged prescription. His car was searched, and the police found several prescription pads that he had stolen from the hospital where he worked. Letterman admitted that he became addicted to painkillers after he was prescribed them for his kidney stones. He pleaded guilty to illegally obtaining drugs, and he entered a drug rehab instead of doing any jail time. On the surface, Gary Letterman seemed like an unlikely murder suspect. He had been married for 27 years. He didn't have any biological children, but he and his wife adopted her niece and nephew after their parents died. They also took in a foreign exchange student from South Korea. Larriman had been a member of the school board and he was involved in youth sports. At the time of Jay Mixer's murder, Larriman was 25 years old and he worked as a pharmaceutical salesman. The police interviewed Larriman and he denied being involved in the murder. The investigators tried to figure out if they could connect him to the murder in other ways than just the DNA. In 1987, Larriman reported that a .22 caliber gun had been stolen from his home. Mixer was killed with a .22 caliber weapon. The police talked to the roommate that Larriman lived with at the time of the murder. He thought that Larriman was strange. Larriman talked about having a drug that could make a woman pass out nearly instantly. He also kept newspaper clippings about the co-ed murders hidden in a closet. Finally, he said that Larriman owned a .22 caliber handgun when Mixer was killed. The police searched Larriman's house and they found two hidden Polaroid photos. They were photos of the 16-year-old exchange student who lived with them. She was nude and appeared to be unconscious. An expert compared Larriman's handwriting to the handwriting on the phone book that was found in the basement of the law school building. The expert determined that was the same handwriting. In November 2004, Larriman was arrested and charged with Jane Mixer's murder. He went to trial in July 2005. The case against Larriman seemed airtight. But there was a big problem. Blood on Mixer's hand was linked to another man who was serving a life term for killing his mother. His name was John Ruelas. The problem is, at the time of Mixer's murder, Ruelas was just 4 years old. The prosecution said that was simply a mistake on the crime lab's part. They said that Ruelas' DNA somehow got mixed up or contaminated the blood on Mixer's hand. The defense argued that if the crime lab could make that mistake, couldn't they make a mistake when linking Larriman's DNA to Mixer's murder? Larriman's trial lasted 2 weeks, and then the jury deliberated for 5 hours. 36 years after Jane Mixer's murder, the jury found 62-year-old Gary Larriman guilty of her murder. In August 2005, he was sentenced to life in prison. Gary Larriman died at the age of 76 in July 2019. His family maintains that he is innocent and was wrongly convicted because of faulty DNA evidence. At the time of this recording, John Norman Collins is 74 years old, and he is serving his sentence at the Ionia Correctional Facility in Ionia, Michigan. He also maintains he is innocent, and he is not a serial killer. But people point out that after he was arrested, the murders of young women in the Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor areas suddenly stopped. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. Our producer, fact checker, and sound designer was Nell Cloutier. If you just discovered this podcast, you should check out our YouTube channel. We have around 325 videos featuring bizarre but true crime stories. You can find it at youtube.com/criminallylisted. But that's all for this week. Thanks again for listening. Please stay safe and take care of yourself.